Mind with Gene Cook Jr., exposing the folly of the atheist fundings.
Today is June 28th, 2008. This is show number 930. We're going to continue our discussion with Paul Minotta in studio, doing the review of Christopher Hitchens' book, God Is Not Great.
Coming to you live from our studios in Southern California, Real Christianity in the Real World, The Narrow Mind.
I hope you've learned something tonight, because you've got a lot of learning to do.
I've learned once again that the atheist can't account for morality. That's what I've learned.
Oh, are you kidding?
Do you sin as a Christian?
Please know that there are different degrees of sin. Worry
Sin.
I do.
You're a Roman Catholic.
I'm answering your question. I'm answering.
Okay, so obviously you didn't get all the Roman Catholicism out of your system when you claim to have been born again.
And now our host, Gene Cook Jr.
Welcome once again, everyone, to another edition of The Narrow Mind. It's a beautiful Saturday morning in Southern California. And I have with me once again to my right, Jonathan Goundry, the Reverend Jonathan Goundry.
The very Reverend.
An elder at Great Oak Church in Temecula, California, along with myself. And on my left, we had to place him on the left because he's Presbyterian, we have Paul Minotta.
But I'm going to let Paul speak.
The left will be right, the least will be last.
I don't remember the left will be right.
Well, I'm adding that one.
It fits for now.
So today we're going to continue our discussion on the book by Christopher Hitchens entitled God Is Not Great. Now, if you listen to last week's show, we did roughly a 40-minute segment and then another 30-minute segment. We've posted the 40-minute segment. I have yet to post the 30-minute segment. I'm going to be doing that today. So this is actually going to be part three, and we're about halfway through chapter one. So we're hoping to finish chapter one, and we've got a special treat for you today. If you don't have anywhere to go, we've got a two-hour show for you today. So we're going to try to tackle as much as we can. I'm really looking forward to getting over to chapter two. There's some really good stuff. Paul's got some really good stuff to share with us concerning his critique of chapter two. And so last week, where we left off was on page 4. And on page 4, we were reading about halfway down, I am inflicting all this upon you because I am not one of these whose chance at a wholesome belief was destroyed by child abuse or brutish indoctrination. I know that millions of human beings have had to endure these things. I do not think that religions can or should be absolved from imposing such miseries. In the very recent past, we've seen the church at Rome, our Church of Rome, befouled by its complicity with the unpardonable sin of child rape, or, as it might be phrased in Latin form, no child left behind.
No child.
He's trying to be funny.
Yeah, I think he is.
But other non-religious organizations have committed similar crimes or even worse crimes. And then he goes on to say, there still remain four irreducible objections to religious faith. So, Jonathan, why don't you read for us with that beautiful northeastern English accent?
Yeah, I
have four objections that are irreducible.
Irreducible.
Irreducible objections to religious faith.
Okay, certainly will. Are you ready for this, listeners? This is devastating. Absolutely devastating.
I'm having a crisis of faith already.
Here we have it. There still remain four irreducible objections to religious faith. That is, wholly misrepresents the origins of man and the cosmos. That because of this original error, it manages to combine the maximum of civility with the maximum of solipsism. That is both the result and the cause of dangerous sexual repression, and that is ultimately grounded on wish thinking.
So there you have it. There is the introduction to the four objections. But he's made some pretty serious claims here. This is the cause of dangerous sexual repression, and it's ultimately grounded on wish thinking.
So, Mr. Paul.
Well, I mean, as we progress in the book, we'll see, hopefully, these objections get a little bit more developed. But as they stand right now, they were just four assertions. There was no attempt to argue for any of it, and it's kind of unclear what he means, because when I read any atheist literature, it massively misrepresents our origins. For example, I was reading a book called The Black Hole Wars by Susskind, a physics professor at Harvard, and his theory is that everything that we see, everything around us, it's a hologram. Stemming from the farthest reaches of outer space. Some others said that we were, our origins are from aliens who deposited some early seeds of life. Both of those can't be true, can't all be true, and so the non-religious viewpoints distort our reality, misrepresent our reality. And also, I would say it's just simply too vague. He's using this broad umbrella term, religious faith. And religious faith distorts reality. But that's simply just too broad to make the claims that he's making about all of them. If you take all of them together, well, then of course they distort reality because they're contradictory. So the Japanese religion that says that a samurai warrior stirred the big pot and then the islands of Japan came up out of the stirring.
Wait a minute, that's not true?
No.
Okay.
No.
And then you take our religion, those are two contradictory terms, and so if you take the whole pot together, they all do. Now, maybe he means, though, each one individually. He could take each one individually and show how it distorts reality. Well, I mean, I'm waiting to see those objections, but it's, you know, that's hardly an objection to Christianity. Of course, we believe that a lot of the other ones do distort reality, but it only distorts reality if it's false. So he needs to show us that Christianity is false. He needs to show us that in order to say that it distorts our origins. It's not solipsistic at all, and he's trying to get a lot of traction out of that term, a philosophical term, which means that only I exist and nothing else. So he's stretching that term to the maximum, his argument that he tries to make for that later, we'll see. It's just an atrocious argument, and he also shows no familiarity with those like Alvin Plantinga, who just utterly decimated the wish objection, wish fulfillment objection. And when he brings that up later, I'll discuss Plantinga's critique of the wish fulfillment objection in more detail later. But he shows no familiarity with the tradition that he's critiquing.
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear that. I would be.
I like the part about the dangerous sexual repression.
Dangerous. Danger.
Yeah. In other words, don't. For example, Christianity. Don't rape women.
That's wrong.
Don't have sexual union with the same sex. It causes wear and tear on the body. Don't abduct children, kidnap children, and exploit them for your sexual pleasures. Don't even have sex with multiple partners. This, of course, is where venereal disease comes from. And don't have sex with anybody who's not your covenant committed spouse. Wow,
he thinks you shouldn't have sex. He says that we think we shouldn't have sex at all. Later in the book, when he critiques the virgin birth, he says the birth canal. He points to all these different religions and says, well, look at all these different religions have a virgin birth. We'll address that more later. But he says, see, religions treat the birth canal or the vagina as a one-way street.
Hmm. Not Christianity.
No.
I couldn't be a Christian if that was true. I've got four children. All right. Let's pick it up on page 5, Jonathan.
Yes. It continues here by saying, we do not rely solely upon science and reason, because these are necessary rather than sufficient factors. But we distrust anything that contradicts science or outrages reason. We may differ on many things, but what we respect is free inquiry, open-mindedness, and the pursuit of ideas for their own sake. We do not hold our convictions dogmatically. The disagreement between Professor Steve J. Gould and Professor Richard Dawkins concern punctuated evolution and the unfilled gaps in post-Darwinian theory is quite wide as well as quite deep, but we shall resolve it by evidence and reasoning and not by mutual excommunication.
That's very charitable.
Well, sure, but of course, if science were necessary for belief to be rational, that's what he said. These aren't sufficient but necessary conditions. So that means you have to have it. Okay. So if science were a necessary condition for belief to be rational, then Hitchens is self-accepting himself again, since this very statement of his cannot be demonstrated or known through science. You can't demonstrate that science is necessary for any belief to be rational. It's not a scientifically verifiable statement. There's a whole host of other claims, too, that science is not necessary for in order to believe them and be rational in believing them. For example, take what we ought to do with our scientific findings. Okay, science might tell us that you could use a laser to sharpen metal, to sharpen a piece of metal, but it can't tell us whether we should stick that piece of metal in someone's chest. That's a question science can't speak to. Science is simply silent and unnecessary for answering those types of questions. It may be necessary in the sense that it gives us some ideas of the facts, but it will never tell us what we ought to do. It can tell us that this is sharp, and then we know that you don't take sharp objects and stick them in people's chests for the fun of it. Now, of course, he can, the atheist, and like Hitchens, he can just strap all those questions down, the ethical questions, questions about the reliability of memory, sense experience, right? Because you can't show that by science, because you'd be using it to show it. So sense experience, all those things, maybe he can just strap them on the Procrustean bed and chop off the legs and say, well, those just aren't important questions. So science answers all the important questions, and then when I bring up, well, how does it tell me how I ought to treat my neighbor? Well, that's not an important question. So maybe he'll do that as a possible rebuttal. And also, I'm wondering, why does he treat science as some sort of reified thing that's out there that we can contradict? We don't contradict, quote-unquote, science. Now, if he means we contradict specific scientific theories, he might point out that he doesn't contradict something Dawkins said, then he's contradicted himself, because, of course, people contradict scientific theories. He just brought one up, Stephen Jay Gould and Richard Dawkins, their different views, their disparate views on...
That contradict each other.
Right. And so, I don't even understand what he means. No one contradicts science taken as some abstract thing, but if he means no one... We don't ever contradict a scientific theory, he's wrong, because he just pointed one out. And he also says, well, but we'll resolve these things by means of free inquiry. But that's just... he's just trying to pull the wool over our eyes. Because what happens with Dawkins and Gould. Okay, Gould says something. Gould and Roos, they say something about religion. I read some quotes earlier that religion isn't the evil force that a Dawkins says it is. Well, Dawkins says, I just can't believe they're being honest. You see, to contradict Dawkins' view of the universe and how atheists should carry themselves is to commit a sin. Dawkins doesn't resolve things by science or intellectual inquiry. Rather, he says of Gould this, quote, I can't believe that he meant half of the stuff he said in his books, unquote. Or Dawkins also believes that all intelligent people are atheists. And
it doesn't sound very open-minded to me.
Well, that's not open-minded, and here's what he's...
Very dogmatic.
It is. He says, you have to be intelligent to be an atheist. And so when you come to him and go, well, let's resolve this scientifically. I'm going to bring some intelligent people in front of you, and we'll see what you say. Okay, so here's Dawkins' resolution of that according to an objective, open-minded method that Hitchens said that all atheists employ. Okay, so this was taken from Gary Wolfe's article, he's an atheist, in called The Church of Nonbelievers in Wired Magazine, November 2006. Quote, Dawkins looks forward to the day when the first U.S. politician is honest about being an atheist. Highly intelligent people are mostly atheists, he says, quoting Dawkins. Not a single member of either House of Congress admits to being an atheist. It just doesn't add up. Either they're stupid or they're lying. And they have got to have a motive. And have they got a motive for lying? Of course they've got a motive. Everyone knows that an atheist can't get elected. So that's Dawkins. When you bring up an intelligent person to him, he says, well, he's lying. He's either lying or he's just extremely stupid.
Paul, is that because intelligent people don't vote? I don't get it. If an atheist can't get elected, and most intelligent people are atheists, it would seem to me that if intelligent people voted, unless they're a minority...
Well, he would say that they're the minority, and he's trying to bring them out with his book.
If intelligent atheists are a minority, then it must not be that self-evident.
Well, he might say the majority are stupid.
The majority of the people? Basically, yeah, everybody that disagrees with him.
So, that's right.
So it's quite elite.
It's not very open-minded.
No.
I think we should excommunicate him from the Church of Atheists.
Half of his colleagues at the University of Oxford are stupid because they believe in God.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Wow.
Let's continue reading, Jonathan.
Yeah, I'm on page 8 now, and he continues by saying, God did not create man in his own image. Evidently, it was the other way about, which is the painless explanation for the profusion of gods and religions and the fratricide both between and among faiths that we see all about us and that has so retarded the development of civilization. Past and present religious atrocities have occurred not because we are evil, but because it is a fact of nature that human species is biologically only partially rational. Evolution has meant that our prefrontal lobes are too small and our adrenal glands are too big. And our reproductive organs apparently designed by committee, a recipe which alone or in combination is very certain to lead to some unhappiness and disorder.
Well, there's a lot of things to say in response to that.
Yeah, I'm thinking of a few.
He says man made God in man's image. Okay, not only is this yet another assertion, Hitchens just showed that man is to blame for all the evil in the world, not religion.
Mm-hmm.
If man invented this most poisonous thing, then man's to blame, and that fits quite nicely within Christian worldview, Mr. Hitchens. And it's also odd to hear an evolutionist would say that the development of civilization is being, quote-unquote, retarded. Okay, retarded, that seems assumes some sort of a purpose or goal or some sort of a normative stance, but evolution just cannot account for any of that within their worldview. There's no ultimate purpose or telos or norms out there that nature or civilization is progressing towards. Okay, evolutionist Gaylord Simpson writes, quote, "Man is the result of a purposeless and natural process that did not have him in mind." Unquote. And in The Blind Watchmaker, Richard Dawkins explained that, quote, "all appearances to the contrary, the only watchmaker in nature is the blind forces of physics, albeit deployed in a very special way. A true watchmaker has foresight. He designs his cogs, springs, and plans their interconnections with a future purpose in mind's eye. Natural selection, the blind, unconscious, automatic process which Darwin discovered, and which we now know is the explanation for the existence and apparently purposeful form of all life, has no purpose in mind. It has no mind and no mind's eye. It does not plan for the future. It has no vision, no foresight, no sight at all. It can be said to play the role of a watchmaker in nature. If it could be said to play that role, it is a blind watchmaker." So, what does Hitchens mean then when he says that civilization is being retarded?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's what Dawkins says in his book, River Out of Eden, that we should expect out of or in civilization. Quote, "In a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt. Other people are going to get lucky. And you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no good, no evil, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference." Hitchens is trying to find a rhyme and a reason for all this religious fratricide and these atrocities, as if religion is retarding development. No, Hitchens, what's going on that you see is just what you would expect to see if everything was, if there was no good and evil, no design and no purpose. And lastly, I would just point out that he, obviously, I know you guys were probably keyed in on this too, that he says all the evils occur because we are partly rational. Now, not only is that going to be a bummer to Dawkins, who we just read earlier, that says all the highly intelligent, smart people in the world are atheists, to find out that he's just partly rational, it's not going to sit well with him. But what he's saying is, it's because of how evolution made us that the evils occur. So mammy nature's to blame. Okay, mammy nature poisons everything. And since, the problem is man, there's no warrant to think that the evils in the world would end if religion were eradicated. He said it's because man is partly rational, so it has nothing to do with religion. He's not fighting, the right battle if he wants to end all the poison by ending religion. He needs to get converted and go out into the mission field if he wants to end all the poison in the world. See, Hitchens just showed up to the battle with the Christian, showed up to the battlefield in his underwear.
Quite a disturbing thought.
Now, I find it interesting also that Dawkins is being honest. When it comes to the question of morality, Dawkins says there isn't any. One guy's lucky and one guy's unlucky. So why is it that atheists are always trying to account for morality? If you go to my video, Atheism Defeated on YouTube, comment after comment
we can account
by
for
atheists, morality is altruistic, it's the product of evolution, it's how we survive. Dawkins, at least, is trying to be consistent and says, it doesn't matter. There is none. You know? What was that quote about one guy's unlucky?
It was, in a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, others are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it.
There you go.
Nor any justice.
So either you need, if you're an atheist out there and you have been trying to defend morality or trying to say, well, this is why morality exists, you need to stop if you're a fan of Dawkins, if you're a fan of Richard Dawkins. You need to say there's no rhyme or reason to it.
Well, actually, to be fair to Dawkins, and we could obviously critique this view as well, Dawkins says, hey, that's the way it is in nature. That's the way that it really is, and we have these genes, and they're selfish genes, and they want to get into the next gene pool, and so you would expect us to be selfish and not altruistic. But Dawkins then says, basically, mankind has gotten to a point in his evolutionary development that he's able to rise above that, and then sit back in some godlike fashion, and then redirect his genes or judge his genes, and so Dawkins is going to try to bring in morality. Even despite this quote.
Well, then the watchmaker is not blind.
Well, no, it is. He just said this. He says that we have this isn't something that was.
Yeah, but the watchmaker has developed eyes. If you're going to put it in those terms, it seems to me that the watchmaker has developed human eyes that now are directing the path of evolution to go a certain direction.
Right. Okay.
Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. It has developed its own eyes.
Right. Right. It's developed.
But just
its own eyes.
In a very limited area, though. Okay. It has nothing to do with with evolution in the broad scheme of things. So he's going to try to justify morality. I don't think that his view works at all. I just want to be fair to him. He's not going to come and say, oh yeah, just go ahead and rape women, do whatever you want to, because there's no morality. He's going to try to give an answer, and Hitchens does as well. Hitchens is very confused in this book. He seems to intimate that morality is an innate, some sort of an innate idea in man, that we just know these things are wrong. But later in a debate, not in this book, but in the debate he had with Douglas Wilson, he said, when Wilson kept pressing him on this question, he said that morality just evolved. Mm-hmm. So, but we'll bring all of that in later.
All right, let's continue reading.
Yes, so we're still on page 8 here, but we're at the bottom of the page, the last paragraph. I read it to you. It says, if you read Hawking on the event horizon, that theoretical lip of the black hole, over which one could, in theory, plunge and see the past and the future, except that one would, regrettably, and by definition, not have enough time, quote unquote. I should be surprised if you can still go on grasping at gaping at Moses and his unimpressive burning bush. If you examine the beauty and symmetry of the double helix and then go on to have your own genome sequence fully analysed, you will be at once impressed that such a near perfect phenomenon is at the core of your being and reassured. End of sentence.
So what Hitchens wants to say is, you know, you religious people, he's trying to attack sort of maybe a belief or an idea that some people have that keeps them believing in their religion, that we can be, that we're awed by nature. Just how can you explain this awe and this wonder in nature if you're, you know, if you don't have a belief in God? So Hitchens wants to say, no, no, we can have that too, and this is greater than what you have. We can, you know, stand in awe at the double helix and various cosmological happenings.
Yeah.
And, well, so that's what he's trying to say, but he wants to say, you know, losing religion doesn't mean we have to lose wonder and awe. But, of course, all this, you know, all this means is that he can attach wonder and awe in a subjective way to the universe. What is wondered and awed over isn't itself wonderful and awesome. Okay, no Christian denies that an atheist can attach subjective wonder and amazement to whatever he wants. If this is a free country, and if Hitchens wants to be stand in admiration over a piece of dog poo, he can do that.
Well, it depends if he's a farmer or not, you know. That could be fertilizer. As we say in the south of England,
but
we need fertilizer.
It could be, and Christian might stand in wonder over itself, but Dawkins only assigns subjective judgment to it. So what the Christian says is, no, these things are wonderful. They really are wonderful. For Hitchens, they're not. What he's saying is, I really just want to think they're wonderful. It's wonderful to me. It causes the heebie-jeebies inside of me. So, you know, a Christian doesn't deny that. He's just misstated the actual argument, though, or the actual idea that Christians have. But let's really look at the actuality of Hitchens' world. Okay, in A Free Man's Worship, Bertrand Russell says, "Such is the world which science presents for our belief, that man is the product of causes which had no provision of the end they were achieving, that his origin, his growth, his hopes and his fears, his loves and his beliefs are all the outcome of accidental collections of atoms, that no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual beyond the grave, and all the labors of all the ages, all the devotion, all the aspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in a vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All of these things, it is not quite, if not quite beyond dispute, are so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand." So Hitchens, or Russell, saying there is nothing in the world, there's nothing to wonder, stand in wonder and awe over, and what we have, what we do, our institutions that do wonder and awe, they're going to be brought to nothing, and they're just subjective enterprises that man's engaged in. And I would also like to point out, you know, when Jonathan read that passage, Hitchens takes a lot of shots at the designer and says, "Oh, look at this junky design," and we saw that in our first part of the show, that Hitchens likes to point out, look at how junky parts of creation,
vermin,
and he's going to point out later in his chapter on the design, he'll point out about how bad man is, how poorly designed man is, and we'll see it's actually quite funny. He wants to be something like an El Chupacabra, but we'll get to that later. He says, notice that he said that that our DNA was it's a near perfect phenomena at the core of our being. And so he's admitting here, later on he'll say, look at man, he's so shoddy and messed up, but now he's saying we have a near perfect phenomena at the core of our being.
Right, we're near perfect, or we have a near perfect phenomenon, like you said. But he just got done saying that our adrenal glands are too large and our frontal lobes are too small. and...
Well, partially rational.
Yeah, partly rational, right. So, which is it?
Well, I mean, of course he'll say, well, the nearly perfect part is the DNA. The other stuff isn't so perfect that I'm pointing, that the adrenal glands and stuff like that.
Right.
As if the two aren't related.
Yeah, so he's trying to say that at the core of who we are, we're essentially close to perfection. But as you get to our extremities or other facets of mankind that are based upon our DNA and our nature, those things are imperfect and need working on.
Right, and of course the term nearly perfect means nothing for the evolutionist because that's a normative claim. And science deals with, remember Hitchens said, you know, we got to be scientists about these things. We resolve them scientifically. Well, science resolves things by means of description. It describes.
Right.
But now Hitchens is bringing in, is trying to sneak in a normative term, perfect. But he can't make those sorts of terms. He has no standard by which to judge perfect and imperfect. There's no norm, you know, in nature by which to judge perfect and, you know, imperfect. There's no ruler out there. So he's just, you know, acting like he's holding his holdover from Christianity.
Right. Only Christianity can make, well, we would argue consistently make prescriptive declarations that this is the way things should be. And the only reason why we can make those type of declarations is because God has told us what the standard is. Men should act a certain way. Men should worship in truth and in spirit. So we're the only ones, really, I would say, argue consistently that can make those type of prescriptive claims. All atheism can do and science can do is make descriptive claims. Well, this is the way we've observed it.
Yeah, and those descriptive claims are fallible.
Yeah.
The principle of induction, for example. Well, if you open up one duck and see that it has a heart, if you don't have the uniformity of nature, how do you conclude that all ducks have hearts? Now, they do. And I think a lot of, maybe Paul might want to weigh in here, a lot of scientists do accept there is a problem with the principle of induction. But even in that descriptive world of science, it's still quite fallible and flawed. Would you agree, Paul?
Yeah, well, I mean, the honest scientist admits that. They say that it's a tentative inquiry, which, of course, you'll see in Hitchens, you know, treats it as if it's a messiah, and he's very bold about the claims. It is a fallible method of knowledge. So, Hitchens seems to act as if science is the great messiah. It answers all our questions. It will save us any problem we have. Remember what we just read the page earlier. He said we're going to debate things. We're going to have questions. We're not going to agree, but we're going to resolve them scientifically. Okay, so it's solo scientifica.
Solo scientifica. I like that, apart from the fact that it's wrong, but I like the way it sounds.
That would make a nice t-shirt.
Solo scientifica.
Hey, infidel guy, if you're listening, maybe you could sell some t-shirts like that on your website. Or the Rational Response Club. Maybe you guys could sell some new beanies or something. Or some wrist bracelets. Why don't we continue reading there, Jonathan?
Yes, we're now on page 10. And at the center of the page and paragraph here. It says, and I am content to think that some contradictions will remain contradictory. Some problems will never be resolved by the mammalian equipment of human cerebral cortex, and some things are indefinitely unknowable. Indefinitely unknowable.
Yeah, I don't get that at all. There are contradictions in nature. I mean, does he mean there are actual contradictions in nature? Doesn't that outrage reason? Didn't he say on page 5 that he would never outrage reason? And if it's acceptable to believe some contradictions will remain contradictory, and if he isn't irrational to believe that these are actual contradictions, then how much more can the believer appeal to paradoxes in her faith? Or when Hitchens points out contradictions in the Bible, as we'll see later, you know, what's the problem? Why can't we just say, well, there's contradictions in the world? Hitchens's world can have contradictions in it, and that's rational to believe that, and they'll never be resolved. Then when he comes and points out contradictions in the Bible, even though I wouldn't do this, but I could just say, well, there's some true contradictions in the world.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that are indefinitely unknowable.
Right.
That's what he says.
Mm-hmm. So I don't understand that at all. If he means that there are actually existing contradictions, I mean, I didn't know that he was a closet dialetheist, but that's a...
that's another discussion.
That's another discussion.
Isn't it, Mr. Paul?
Yes.
But on the same page, he continues to say, thus, the mildest criticism of religion is also the most radical and most devastating one. Religion is man-made. Even the men who made it cannot agree on their prophets or redeemers or gurus actually said or did. Still less can they hope to tell us the meaning of later discoveries and developments which were, when they began, either obstructed by their religions or denounced by them. And yet the believers still claim to know, not just to know, but to know everything, not just to know that God exists and that he created and supervised the whole enterprise, but also to know that he demands of us.
What he demands of us.
Sorry, what he demands.
Yes. From our diet, to our observances, to our sexual morality.
Right, and that's what he's going to try to bring these
How
out.
How dare
later,
those creators?
How dare they?
When he gets on his pig chapter, you know, he's and pig and diet, and he doesn't like Christians imposing dietary laws on people, and we'll see how he's has a rather odd view of the dietary laws, but. Regardless, one of the things I haven't pointed out yet is that Hitchens never bothers to define religion. Now, you would think you have a book, God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. Hitchens never bothers to define God, and he never bothers to define religion. So it's really hard to even follow an argument or to see if he's using terms appropriately. And what this does, it lets him get away with a lot. He can say, well, religions, they're all this. Religion is insufficient because they disagree with each other. Well, of course, I disagree with the Hindu. That's just something that's obvious. So he tries to act as if it's some fault against religion when totally radically opposite faiths disagree with each other. But he treats them both under the same umbrella term, religion, and in trying to get a lot of traction out of that term. That's hardly a scholarly or scientific way to proceed, though, to not define your terms, not do make any distinctions within the umbrella term that you're using. And Hitchens also, what I can maybe do for him, even though he didn't do this in the book, he edited a book called The Portable Atheist. And in that book, there's a whole bunch of articles from various atheists, a bunch of different papers. And one of the articles is by Daniel Dennett. And Dennett defines religion in that article. And so I can say, well, maybe Hitchens will use this definition of religion. That's his definition. Since he included it in The Portable Atheist and included that chapter, maybe he agrees with that, and that's why he chose it. Now, that definition is this, quote, the belief in the religion is, quote, the belief in the supernatural and the belief that we need to seek God's approval, unquote. Now, that's a horrible definition, first off, but that wipes out Buddhism. Okay, Buddhism doesn't seek God's approval. So in this book, Religion Poisons Everything, Hitchens attacks Buddhism. And he even somewhat admits, well, this isn't a religion, but I'm going to throw it in here anyway. With that he has to do that because all the evils he laid at the Buddhist feet, if it's not a religion, we could just say, oh, well, look at all the evil non-religion causes. So Hitchens has this odd definition of religion, and if it is what Daniel Dennett says, then it doesn't allow Buddhism, but yet Hitchens includes Buddhism. So I don't really know how to follow him, how to follow his argument here. It's just a sloppy mess of things thrown together. And I think this is an example of how he's dishonest. He'll admit, well, Buddhism's not a religion, but we're going to throw it in here anyway, because it's basically like a religion. But if you're going to have Buddhism be a religion, well, you can have all sorts of stuff being a religion. Watching football could be a religion. Some people are very, quote-unquote, religious about watching a football game. So he needs to define that, but he doesn't. And to stick with Christianity, it simply begs the question to say that it's man-made. You can't just keep saying that without, demonstrating it. And also, other religions, they don't have to be man-made. they could be the result of demons. And I think some other religions...
the doctrine of demons, right? The Bible speaks of the doctrine of demons.
Right. And, you know, you could see various animism or voodoo as resulting, having a demonic origin, so they don't have to be man-made either. So when Hitchens wants to say, oh, well, you just think your religion isn't man-made, but everyone else's. So I just go one step further and say yours is man-made. Well, I don't have to think that any of them are man-made. All of them could be influenced, and there's been studies shown that Muhammad and Joseph Smith, there's tremendous similarities to the both of them. They were very involved in the occult, so I don't have to say that any of them were man-made. And also, I'd point out that he has a double standard. Back on page 5, he made a big deal that not all atheists had to agree. He says, well, we don't have to agree. We don't all agree with each other. So
right, we'll work it out in time.
Right. But now, when it comes to religious adherence, there's this big problem because they all disagree. And also, I'm really struggling to figure out why would the men who made religion not to be able to agree on what their prophet said? Okay, he said the men who invented religion couldn't agree on what their prophets said, past tense. What their prophets, redeemers, or gurus actually did. If these guys made the religion, there were no prophets and redeemers and gurus that were saying something before them. You can't have someone saying a religion before you make it up. And he also claims that we say we know everything. And that's just ridiculous. No Christian says we know everything. I don't even know where he's getting that. In one sense, in a very broad sense, the Christian knows everything. I know something about everything. Here's my limited omniscience. Everything is either creator or created. So I know something about everything, but so does Hitchens at that broad scale. He knows that everything is physical or material. And he acts, incredulous about our knowledge of God. He says, "How could they know what a God says?" Well, if God told you, that would be one way to know.
He speaks.
So he's just making one argument from incredulity after another. How could they do this? I don't see how that could happen. I don't understand this. I don't understand that. That's not arguing. To go in and just say, I don't understand how you do that. I don't get this. I don't get that.
So continuing. On page 11, we have him saying here, the person who is certain and who claims divine warrant for his certainty belongs now to the infancy of our species. It may be a long farewell, but it has begun and, like all farewells, should not be protracted.
Okay, so let's say goodbye to Hitchens, farewell to Hitchens, because on page 4, 6, and 46, and other places, he says he's certain.
There you
that
go.
Was a typo.
Yes. I'm sure in the next publication that will be...
That'll be edited out.
That's right. That'll be taken care of.
Let me read that again, Jonathan. The person who is certain and who claims divine warrant for his certainty belongs now to the infancy of our species. So, Paul, is he just qualifying this as people who are certain and they claim certainty because of divine warrant?
Well,
Would that exclude him?
I thought of that. That's one possible... rebuttal. That's one possible way to read him, but I don't think that he says that, because in other places he'll leave that out. He'll just say they think that they're certain. Like another place in the book, he says they just claim that they're certain.
But even if he did mean that, if a religious person claims to be certain about something and they've received the certainty from God, and they're wrong, then their certainty is no more valid or invalid than anyone else's certainty, because they might be wrong too, right?
Right. Well, I was going to say, it's really, if that's what he means, is, well, I can claim certainty, but the believer can't, because if the believer claims certainty because of a supernatural source, then that kind of certainty is not allowed. And that's just a bad argument, because, well, I mean, Hitchens would have to at least grant, for argument's sake, that if an all-knowing being who knew everything, who can never be wrong, and made you in such a way as you could be sure of what he said, okay, and you could know his word, and if he told you something, let's say he said there's a penny under that rock, you could be certain of it. So I don't understand why this would be that big of a deal for a deal breaker for Hitchens. He would have to say that we could be certain, if a God existed.
Yeah. Well, Gene, I noticed you've highlighted in your book there an interesting sentence.
Yeah, at the bottom of page 11, it says, "My parents did not try to impose any religion. I was probably fortunate in having a father who had not especially loved his strict Baptist Calvinist upbringing and a mother who preferred assimilation." So I guess I highlighted that because I found it interesting that he came from the faith or the denomination of Christianity that I myself exist in, Baptist and Calvinistic. But I don't know many Baptist Calvinistic fathers who are not especially in love with the Reformational faith. I mean, do you? I mean, if it seems to me if they were, they'd stop coming to church or they'd go to a different church.
Yeah. So it seems here that it was his grandfather who was the strict Baptist Calvinist.
Right.
I would love to listen to a sermon of his grandfather. What did he say? What did he preach?
Well, he doesn't say that he was a preacher, does he?
No, but I'm saying if he did, I think that's a fair point. He doesn't say that he preached, but if he did so, or if he had conversations,
right.
What type of conversations did he have with Hitchens as a young boy, if he was contemporary with his father, so grandfather? So yes, I am reading a lot into that, but I would be interested to find out if that was indeed the case. So I noted that as well, but it's not highlighted in Paul's. So.
Yeah, Paul didn't think the Baptist part was of,
but the Calvinist.
Worth mentioning.
Well, no, it actually is. I think in mine you could see I wrote in the margins, I said, oh, so here's someone with a religious upbringing who wasn't abused, but later he claims that all people with religious upbringings are abused.
The problem was that he wasn't baptized in church and seen as part of the covenant community. This is where the whole breakdown began. This
that
individualistic
was.
Idea of Christianity.
Yeah.
But kind of he was baptized as a professor, though.
Was he?
Yes. In the Anglican Church, you said.
As an adult?
Yes.
Wow.
Wow.
As a professor?
Yep, that's right.
I can't wait to get to that part.
Yeah, interesting. So, we're on now page 12, and this, I think, is the final reading for chapter 1. But it's right down at the bottom of the page, and he says, "Religious faith is precisely because we are still evolving creatures, ineradicable. It will never die out, or at least not until we get over our fear of death, and of the dark, and of the unknown, and of each other. For this reason, I will not prohibit it, even if I thought I could. Very generous of me, you may say, but will the religious grant me the same indulgence? I ask because there is a real and serious difference between me and my religious friends, and the real and serious friends are sufficiently honest to admit it."
Yeah, well, Hitchens has this view that the early advocates of our religion were these stupid, fearful, ignorant, cowering humans who had to invoke God did it for everything. And he doesn't prove that, and that's just a false assumption he has of Christianity. Nowhere in the Bible will you find the idea that when a volcano happened or an earthquake happened, they were running around saying, God did it. God did it. He needs to do everything. When a rock falls, God must be pulling it down. That wasn't even that wasn't in their mind. And I think that they're a lot more intelligent than Hitchens gives ancient people credit for. But in the Bible, we're told many, many places not to have fear. And this is one of Hitchens' big point that. Religion won't be done until we are not afraid. Religion teaches fear, but over and again, we're told not to fear things. We're told not to fear any evil. We're told we don't need to fear anything because if God is for us, who can be against us?
God has not given us a spirit of fear.
Right. So he's not even he's just making up this critique against Christianity and showing absolutely no familiarity with the Bible. What is a big critique for him, i.e. religion teaches you to be fearful of everything, is actually in our Bible flatly contradicted all over the place. And if religion really was a cause, the cause for evil, as he says it was, as he says it is, if it's his cause for the tremendous evils in the world, almost every bad thing you point to, all these sexual repressions that he doesn't like, harming children, the wars, the violence, the Jehovah's Witness not giving their children blood transfusions, religion is the cause for every evil in the world. But then he says he doesn't want to prohibit it. You know, if I thought something was the cause of child abuse and the poisoning of everything, I would try to put an end to it. I would say that it should be prohibited. And yeah, I'll hit on this point later.
Yeah, he says on page 13, the very last paragraph, "As I write these words and you read them, people of faith are in their different ways planning your and my destruction and the destruction of all the hard-won human attainments that I have touched upon." If that's the case, why be tolerant toward it?
Right.
Why say this can continue? Why not say this must stop?
Right. And later it's going to get very embarrassing for him. See, he has to say that. He has to say, "I don't want to prohibit it." And I'm going to hit on this a lot later. But he says later on in his book, around page 40 or 42 or something like that, he says, anyone who prohibits something that's optional secretly wants to participate in that thing. And Hitchens also claims in the book that religion is optional. So if Hitchens were to say in this chapter, if he were to end it saying that he wants to prohibit religion, then he would have to say that he secretly wants to participate in religion because he claims it's optional. But I'll make some other points about that as well later. And he also indicates, you know, I really wouldn't like to be a religious person and Hitchens' friend. Hitchens says that he has religious friends.
I'd like to know what's going on there. I think this is the second time he's mentioned this relationship that he has with his religious friends in chapter one.
Right. But what's interesting, if we turn back, we didn't quote this, on page 9, he indicates that any religious friend is a false friend. He says any, because if he's being, this is a religious friend that he has, so I assume that they really believe their religion, or at least, you know, profess to, and are honest in what they believe, so they would try to console him or tell him things about the world according to their perspective. Well, he says anyone who does that, anyone who gives you these false religious hopes, is a false friend. So Hitchens just called all his religious friends false friends, based on what he said on page 9.
Yeah, now who's the intolerant one?
Right, and also I want to know, what does he want us to prohibit? His non-belief? He says, "Well, I don't want you to allow me to do the things I want to do." Well, I'm fine with that. He can be a non-believer. I won't force him to convert. Most Christians I know won't. I don't really know any Christian or religious person, besides maybe a fanatic, who wants to hold a gun to his head and force Hitchens to convert. He's free to go ahead and live the way that he wants to and write these books.
And profit from them.
Right.
Given, I think, all of our understanding of common grace in the New Testament age, he's not even living in the Old Testament, where you are the inhabitants of the land of Canaan, and all of a sudden the Israelites are coming in to wipe you out. Or they're not under a theocracy whereby you have these penal sanctions that are immediately enforced upon some idolatrous sin. So those have been delayed to judgment day. So he's living in good times. I mean,
yeah. And Hitchens thinks that his view of the Bible, here's his, remember we talked about earlier, his master class in exegesis was when he was a 9-year-old from Mrs. Watts. That's how he learned exegesis. So his exegesis of those Old Testament passages, Jonathan, is that if it's in the Bible at all, you have to be doing it today.
Yeah. It's an error that I hear over and over again. This type of, well, if you're going to quote Leviticus and say homosexuality is abomination, are you going to sell your daughter into slavery? Are you going to execute somebody for breaking the Sabbath? And people get convinced by that type of argumentation. They find it compelling.
Right, because they're too lazy to do any Bible study, to at least read our books to find out how, you know, you do exegesis properly.
How everything fits together.
Right. Pick up a couple good commentaries and take the time to say, well, let's see how these Christians view it. Because, you know, we're not these bumbling idiots who just said, well, I never saw that. I never saw that it said something about a dietary law right next to homosexuality, and I say one's okay and the other isn't. Thanks for pointing that out to
Holy
me.
Holy cow. What am I going to
do? I guess I can't eat lobster anymore. You guys are ruining my dinner. All right, we are, I think we're done with chapter one. What we're going to do is we're going to take a short break. We're going to stop the recording. We're going to come back in the second hour and begin with chapter two. So stick with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
The Narrow Mind with Pastor Gene Cook Jr. Love him or hate him, you're still listening to him.